The following episode of The Love Bomb is brought to you by Spoke. It's a new free listening app from SiriusXM.
The following is an at-will presentation.
Story of fiction. Baby girl born painted pink before she was washed of red, tagged and ribbon tied, hearts and flowers bled, bagged to think she'll grow up like the rest of them, bodied, femme, flagged. Daddy's little girl will wear skirts and one day grow breastuses because that's what bestus is, says who. Years go by and she grows, different, significant, peers development distinct, one way, only one way, effeminate. Survival of the prettiest, the fittest, she plays with trains and trucks, prefers hair short, cuts like sports, wears shorts, plays outside, feels different on the inside than she looks on the outside, feels more like a boy, labeled tomboy, but who the fuck is this Tom guy anyway, and who's to say that Tom isn't gay? So she's gender dysphoric, she'll explore it, she'll tape and bind her mammary glands for it, she'll dress like a man, fit like a man, walk, talk, and spit like a man, she will become a he will become, he'll spill the tea and shoot the tea, hormone, testosterone, soft-packed, hard-packed, boned, his voice will drop, facial hair pop, his cycle will stop, he will go under an altar and he'll cop the pass card, it'll be hard, he may lose family and friends along the way while he bends and blends, but he'll gain more when he can. He's F to M. He's a trans man, in my mind, just like any other leading man. He's not just a survivor. He's transformed, aliver. This is a story of nonfiction. Zeke Smith was born January 25th, 1988. Same year as me. Zeke is best known for being outed as a trans man on national television while competing on CBS's infamous game show, Survivor. This is his bio for the show. Zeke lives in Brooklyn, New York. He is self-proclaimed sharp, devilish, and unstoppable. His hobbies include writing, improv, going to the gym, and cooking. His pet peeves are chewing with your mouth open, black shoes with brown belts, and children who do not listen to their mothers. He never really considered himself a millennial. His claim to fame is being ranked one of the top 16 high school debaters in the country his senior year of high school. He got a plaque, and apparently it's been downhill ever since. And he fucking loves Joan Rivers. My favorite part of that bio, it doesn't mention that he is a trans man once. Zeke Smith is a man who happens to be trans.
Explosive shockwaves can cause situations such as body displacement, emotional breakthroughs, relatable flashbacks, and love.
This is a conversation with a human I love named Zeke. So you don't actually consider yourself a millennial?
No, I don't.
I'm just
well,
going to use
like,
that
culturally,
space.
I don't. That label doesn't speak to me.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
I totally understand.
Like, I don't know how to use a computer.
I don't even own a computer.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Well, so how? Sorry, it's rude to ask
it's
a woman
okay.
her age, but how old are you?
I'm 20. I'm turning 29 in July.
Okay, so we're about the same.
Yeah,
age.
We're the same age. Yeah.
And do you identify as a millennial?
I feel like I represent millennial in a lot of ways. I don't know if I myself identify as a.
Because how many Instagram followers do you have?
Like 300.
All right, that makes you a millennial.
Is that what it is?
Right.
Instagram followers.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think like just the conversation about fluidity is like very millennial, right?
Certainly.
I think like I have a podcast, which is very millennial, you know?
Yeah.
I think I'm on a show called Younger, where like I am the millennial generation on the show, right? There's the older generation and the younger generation. So I think like I fit into the box, but in my heart, in my mind, I feel like I'm 194 years old. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I'm the same way. Yeah. You know, I think trans, which is a very millennial thing to me. And I have a mustache and, you know, go on reality television to find myself. These are all very millennial things.
You're wearing a shirt with flamingos on it.
Well, I feel like I dress like a 65-year-old man at a Miami retirement center who's trying to, like, pick up on the ladies.
Let's talk about where you got that shirt, because I think it's pretty millennial how you got that shirt.
Well, it's not. This is one of the. So I wear these goofy shirts. Yeah. If you know me from Survivor, you know I wear goofy shirts. I almost exclusively get them from Bonobos, mm-hmm. who has recently started sending me free shirts.
Millennial.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just think of it as thrifty.
Thrifty, yes.
Shirts
yes.
I would otherwise buy.
Frugal. I love it.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Survivor.
Let's do it.
Like, why?
Yeah.
What was it that got you into it? Why did you want to do it?
Sure.
Yeah.
This is sort of like the crazy thing about my life, is that there is this reality show, which has played such like a important role in developing my sense of self. Mm. So I started watching Survivor about 7 years ago, while I was recovering from top surgery.
Mm.
This is what I did. And this was a point in my life where I was super depressed. I'd left college both because I was like about to fail out and because I was in a relationship with that was just really terrible.
Mm.
And it was a real low point in my life. And, you know, top surgery was sort of like the moment where I mark like life getting better. And it started with watching this crazy game of adventure and social strategy.
Mm.
And I, like anyone who starts watching Survivor, and this is true because I've started so many of my friends watching Survivor since I've been on it, Survivor is like one of the best made shows on television.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It transcends the genre, and it spoke to me, this idea of like, you know, going off into the unknown.
Mm.
And I just binged it. I binged 20 seasons at the time.
Wow.
Yes.
Because we're on what, season 30 something?
We just
now?
Finished 34.
Jesus.
And they are currently filming 36.
Wow.
No end in sight. 18 years.
They just skipped 35.
Well, they've already...
I'm skipped.
So I was watching, you know, I didn't really have friends. When I first came out as trans, I beat like Chaz Bono by like 2 years.
Really?
So the idea of trans men, no one knew what that was, right?
Yeah.
People really didn't even know who trans people were. They were just either prostitutes or murder victims on crime shows.
Mm.
And they were always trans women.
Right.
And I mean, I didn't even know I didn't know trans men were a thing until I was in college.
Yeah.
And I started coming, I mean, I've been LGBT and Q. I've done all shades of the rainbow at various points in my life and started coming out when I was like 13.
Mm. Coming out as?
As a big old dyke.
As a big old dyke at 13.
Yeah.
Okay.
And am now a fun, fabulous gay man. And I'm sure we'll get into all
of
that.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. You know, even me, and I'm a very type A, highly researched person, so I, you know, dove into the internet and read all this queer literature and watched When the Grace and Queer as Folk and ultimately The L Word, and even I, in all of my investigations in the queer life, hadn't encountered this idea of trans masculinity until I got to college.
Mm.
And, you know, I grew up in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
So, I, you know, big Bible belt, Bible beaters, you know, I cut my hair short and it was a problem.
Mm.
Wore leather jackets, bigger problem.
Really, really, really.
Yeah.
Did you go to church every Sunday?
No, my family's not religious. Okay. I mean, I'm very lucky that, like, my dad was, like, on the board of the National Carpenters Union.
Mm.
So come from, like, a very, you know, I would say, you know, shade of blue.
Yeah.
In the midst of a sea of very, very conservative red.
Right.
And my parents, you know, I had to tell my parents I was trans because that was something that they hadn't encountered before. But I never had to tell my parents I was queer.
That you were queer. Yeah.
They just always, you know, and I was also, I think, when I was very little, you know, like would just say, oh, I'm a boy.
Mm. Like at how old?
Three, four,
from
five. Like it was a fight. Like it
really?
Was a, I had to be corrected in that.
Yeah.
Like I did not understand.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have an older brother.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, oh, I'm like him.
You're
you
just
know,
like just him. Yeah.
And then that, I think they thought it was like cute.
Right.
And then it, like, continued.
Well, I mean, I think there was...
And it was not cute anymore.
There's something, weirdly, there's something more socially acceptable about little kids, little girls being more tomboyish than it is for little boys to be like sissies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a word for it. I don't think like...
Well, I think there's also, you know, my parents, when I was like running around playing baseball, I don't think the imminent like concern for and, like getting dirty, I don't think the concern was like... Oh, we've got a little lesbian on our hands. Right. Whereas if you have an effeminate little boy, the concern
the
is like,
first
oh,
thing,
shit,
yeah.
we've got a fag on
exactly.
our hands.
Exactly, yeah.
So I don't think that, you know, for whatever reason, there was a concern of, like, sexuality. I think mm-hmm. it was just, like, there's something wrong. So I never had to tell my parents when I was in high school that I started sleeping with women. I think they just sort of, like, assumed that that was happening.
That was going on, yeah.
And would make comments like, you know, we would be watching Will and Grace together, and I remember my mom being like, you know, I would love my children no matter what, which was great.
Yeah.
You know, they're certainly not like, you know, P-flag march down the street
right.
types of parents, but they're like, yeah, we're just fine with this.
Yeah.
We don't need to talk about it a lot.
For sure.
But anyway, we were talking about why Survivor is significant.
Yeah. We hit like 7 questions in that one question.
Right.
But
you know, so anyway, this is a point in my life where I was, you know, tremendously alone.
Right.
Didn't have any friends. You know, my parents were... I mean, I was living with my parents. They were on board enough for that, but they were still really like freaked out and worried.
Mm.
So I felt tremendously alone. And like the people who sort of became my friends, who became my companions, were these Survivor players
yeah.
and like Jeff Probst, the host,
mm-hmm.
right?
Can we go back to your childhood for a second? Because I have more
okay.
questions. Sorry,
sure.
we're all over the place right now.
No worries.
Were there any other queer people in your family?
No other queer people in my family. No other queer people really in my life.
Yeah.
Certainly no one who was out until. So I'm so glad that my parents like identified me as like smart and eccentric. They didn't know what to do with me, but they knew that there was something going on. And when I was 11, I got sent out of Oklahoma City to the most amazing camp in the world, Stage Door Manor, which is this theater camp in the Catskills that is this magical place that so many people have come out of.
Yes.
And I got to go to Stage Door, and that's really where I came alive. Like, my dream as a child was to be on Broadway.
Right.
That's what I wanted to do.
Mm.
I wanted to star in musicals.
Mm.
And I spent a lot of time in voice lessons and dance lessons and acting lessons, years and years of my life. Can't sing, can't dance, can't act. Not a lick.
What
Not
happened?
At all. Zero talent. But I, you know, as a kid, it didn't matter because I was like
you were
diligent.
Playing.
I
yeah.
could. I had a good stage presence. I could learn my lines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at Stage Door, it is staffed by all of these like theater people from New York,
right.
including like a significant amount of like queer people.
Yeah, for sure.
And I was just like, oh my God!
Thank
like these are
you.
My
yes.
yeah. I was just everything was so I inspired and made sense,
right.
and I had this oasis in the summers.
Mm-hmm.
And at Stage Door, they really liked me because I tried really hard, and I was like this like very distressed kid from like the middle of the country. And I think everyone was like, "It's gonna be even though I wasn't like that great, they did keep an eye out for me. And when I finally agreed to like because you can pick to be in a musical or a non-musical.
Uh-huh.
And when I finally stopped checking the musical box and checked, like, you know, either, I got leads in plays, and they would always, like, give me guy parts.
Oh.
Because there are also so many more girls than boys.
Right.
So they would always give me guy parts. And I just was like...
And you were down for it. Yeah, totally.
Loved it. Yeah.
I mean, I've been saying for a while, I've been talking about my theater background in a lot of interviews recently, and it really just is, like thank God I had it. I mean... especially if you want any sort of career in the entertainment industry, like, yes, theater background is perfect. But just, like, for life, what you see, I mean, these are some of the most creative people in theater anywhere across the country that, I mean, it's just this safe haven for, like, queer counterculture to just come together and play dress up and become other people, like...
Right, and, like, you didn't have to, like, label it or
yeah.
identify or speak specifically to what it was. It was just an appreciation that there was... something that needed to be nurtured,
yeah.
and it was really only nurtured at theater camp.
Mm.
And so I would go away, and I would spend 6 weeks there every summer, and it would be – that's where, like, I lived. And then I would just come back to Oklahoma and, like, grin and bear it.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Do you remember the first time you, like, figured out what a trans man was?
Yeah, I remember very distinctly because I'd fool around with guys and girls.
Okay.
I mean, I always – it's funny. Like, I was always like, I'm such, like, an angry, like, butch dyke. But I was always sleeping with guys
yeah.
And just didn't think too much about it.
Huh.
I mean, I was always sleeping with girls, too.
But what was the difference early on?
What was the difference?
Yeah, like
there was no difference. I was just having sex with people, just fooling around. You know?
No. But I mean, was there like a different energy between the two?
Yeah. Well, there was like two guys I had sex with, and I aired away because the thing was when I was with like a dude, then I was like the girl. And okay. I didn't like that.
You didn't like it.
That was no good.
Yeah.
But when I was with girls,
you were the
dude. I got to like express this masculine energy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was in my like dyke days, I was a terror. Mm. I mean, I was like, I wanna go and I'm gonna bang some bitches. I was like a total frat bro.
Really?
I had this like, yeah. I was like, I'm gonna go get some pussy tonight. You know, I did this whole like, I like listened to gangster rap and like,
yes.
I was just, I wore leather jackets. I wore like one stud in my ear and was like, wore like tank tops. And I was like,
I want to see pictures.
Oh, there are no pictures.
Do you mean there's no pictures?
Pictures from the before do not exist.
On purpose?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. I don't like to remember that time.
Yeah.
It was a bad time. I was very unhappy as a person.
No. Yeah, I totally get that.
I'm also like, you know, I would say that there, you know, your gender is a, you know, an ever-evolving, changing, mm-hmm. moving spectrum, and there are people who occupy, you know, the hinterlands of,
right.
you know, outside the binary and beyond the binary. I would say I'm not one of those people. I am, like, highly invested in my masculinity. Mm.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, you would think being trans and being so, you know, vastly queer, I might be exempt from certain, like, you know, pitfalls of machismo. I am not.
Mm, interesting.
I don't like to cry in front of people.
Yeah. Well,
I'm very like, urgh.
So stereotypical masculine.
Right.
What does that mean?
Stereotypical masculine?
Yeah. I mean, is that what it is? Like, not to be vulnerable, not to cry. Like, you know, the things that people don't necessarily love about men in the first place? Is
right.
that what, like, those,
well,
those
I'm not,
checks are?
Well, I'm not saying I'm, like, necessarily invested in them. I think that, like, what is the phrase? Masculinity is fragile.
Mm.
I'm fully willing to admit my masculinity is fragile.
Okay.
But I, like, reinforce it with these other things.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I think it's, yeah, I don't know where it comes from.
Mm.
But no, I'm one of those, like, I am someone who is, like, kind of, like, invested in my manhood in
yeah.
a way that's not, like, hip or millennial right now, I would say.
Right. Has it changed since you've transitioned, or has it been pretty?
Well, right. So there was sort of like the gross bro-y masculinity.
Yes.
During the dyke days.
During the dyke days.
Right. And so I would say during this time, that's when I got to college. I went to college in Boston. And that's when everyone was kind of like, yo, there's this thing, trans, that's you.
Mm.
Like, you should, and I was like, I was very, that like upset me, right? Because as growing up in the Bible Belt, people were like, no, your sexual orientation is wrong. And like, this is the wrong identity for you. And I was like, fuck you, you don't know anything.
Yeah.
And then I got to college expecting to be affirmed in that identity. And yet again, people were like, no.
I
was also
so, yeah.
like looking for community too.
Right.
Because there were no queer people in at least my high school. And I stopped going to theater camp and went to debate camp because debate became my thing. And I was good at it. I was actually recruited to my college to be a debater.
Mm.
And then I was expecting community. And I was like, all right, other dykes. And they were like, no, you're not one of us either. And I'd had that so much in my life.
Interesting.
So many times, like, you know, when I wanted to play with the boys and the boys were like, no, you're not one of us. And I was like, well,
yeah.
And then I would self-exclude from certain groups. And I was like, but this is supposed to be my chance to, like, fit in.
Yeah.
And I, again, didn't fit in. And so people were like, you're trans. And I was like,
this is college.
In college.
Yes.
And I was like, fuck you for 2 years. And then I was like, so I'm trans. Turns out.
I don't know if you guys knew, but
who would have thought? And this was, so I went to Harvard.
Oh, wow. Let's just drop that name. Just pick it up right off the floor right there.
which, you know, liberal Massachusetts had all of these sort of trans-inclusive policies on the books that activist-y students had, you know, lobbied the administration to have. But no one had ever, like, tested them out.
Hmm.
No one had ever transitioned.
Right.
And I was the one who sort of like tested all of these things.
Mm.
And though there are all these policies on the books, people were a little like, oh, we really don't want to like enact these policies. So that was a little complicated, but you know, it was fine. And well, we keep, okay, sure.
No, go ahead.
No, I was like, well, we keep coming back to this place of like, so super depressed and lonely and watching Survivor in my mother's house.
Well, but hold on. What was the deciding factor that led you to understand that you were a trans man? Like, what was it?
There, I think, were two, I would say, like, inciting things.
Yes.
And I think that, so the summer before, so I came out as trans in the fall of 2008.
Okay.
Yes, 8. At the beginning of my junior year. And that whole summer, I spent in New York reading everything about, like, trans. You know, I just, like, I was like, no, I'm not trans. And then everything I wanted to read was, and I just read was trans, and I... it just increasingly became a thing I couldn't get off my mind. Hmm. And then I remember I actually, there's this girl I was dating at the time, and she was really encouraging of it. And then I kind of followed her into, so at Harvard we have this thing called shopping period, where you get to test out the class. Like, you don't pick your classes before, you go and you like test out all the classes and you figure out what you want. And I followed her into this class called Transgender History, which was taught by this brilliant academic named Susan Stryker.
Mm-hmm.
Susan Stryker grew up in Oklahoma.
Mm.
And I took the class, and then about 3 classes in, I was like,
fuck.
You know what, guys? You know what?
Mm.
So, and I remember there was a very specific moment for me, and that was I was on the T, they call it in Boston, on the way back from my therapist office. And my therapist asked me a question. She was like, do you consider yourself a boy? And I got really angry because I got asked that question a lot, and it made me angry every time. And I couldn't get her asking that out of my mind. And I was on the train for like 30 minutes. And when the train stopped at my stop, I looked down at my arm. And I'd wound the strap of my backpack around my forearm so tightly and for so long that my entire arm was blue. And that's sort of like, that was kind of the moment I knew. I was like, yeah, like, you know what that means.
You know
what this means.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's how I knew.
And so you just told everybody?
Well, it's a weird, you know, thing.
Yeah.
Because with sexuality, there is this chance for experimentation, right? Before you, like, announce yourself as, like, gay or bi or fluid or whatever, like, you can go and, like, diddle some guy's dick without there being any consequences,
right?
You can sort of figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But with gender, once you ring the bell, you can't unring it.
Right.
You know, you can't sort of, like, test out being a boy.
Yeah.
You got to either, like, especially back then.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I think now maybe you could, but 9 years ago, there was no, I'm going to experiment with a new name and pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to, like, go in, like, you know, guns blazing.
Right. Because, I mean, 9 years ago, there weren't mid pronouns. There weren't Zays and Zs. And
I think there, like, were in the academic literature.
Oh, there were, yeah.
But the idea that, yeah, like, that you would announce yourself as someone who, like, went by they.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, it's a very, like, you know, weird process of, like, deciding how I was going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, well, I guess I'm just going to write this email and I got to pick a name and I got a baby book and look through names.
How did you come up with Zeke?
Well, I'd always been drawn to Zeke. In high school, I named my car Zeke.
Mm. What kind of car was it?
It was like a BMW from the 80s.
Yes.
It was pretty sweet.
I had a Mercedes from the 80s in high school.
Yeah, it was silver. It was cool.
I love it. I want to
add memory of like blowing a football player in the back of that car.
Nice.
Yeah.
But Zeke isn't like your original name. It's not like your original name didn't start with a Z or anything. Nothing like that.
No.
I feel like I want to ask you what your first name was, but you're not going to want to tell me, and that's totally okay.
No, I'll tell you the nickname I went by growing up was Tum Tum.
Tum Tum.
Which is from the movie The Three Ninjas.
Yes, I love Tum Tum.
Which is still one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I mean, incredible. Three Ninjas kicked back, though, when they went to Japan. Oh, really? You're an original fan?
I'm OG with the Three Ninjas.
Oh, no. Tokyo was the best one.
Really?
Yeah. Well, do you remember?
I haven't seen it. Like, I remember seeing it in theaters. Well, because I think what disappointed me is I, like, identified so hardcore with Tum Tum.
Yeah.
Because he kicked ass and he got to eat all the time.
Yes.
And I liked that, too. I was like, I want to eat and do martial arts.
Yes.
And I was also like the little brother, so that like, right. And then I think I was so invested in Tom Tom because the thing about Kick Back is it's all new actors, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe Rocky's the same or Colt's the same, but it's definitely a different Tom Tom.
No, it's the same Tom Tom. It's the same Tom Tom, and I think that the oldest one is different.
Really?
Yeah, the third one is a different Tum Tum.
Okay. That's the one where they're in New Mexico, like, fighting against water pollution
exactly.
or something.
Exactly. There's, like, some, like, Native appropriation that's happening.
Right. Yeah, it's about, like, it's about, like, a Native American water, like, yes. rights. It's, like, very, like, you know, it's very, like, you know, apropos right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, present.
Maybe we should do a different podcast where we do, like, a Three Ninjas we rewatch.
Exactly. Well, do you remember Surfing Ninjas, that movie?
No.
That came out right around the same time. And it was about these ninjas in Los Angeles. Oh, my God. Go back and watch that one.
Surf Ninjas.
Surf Ninjas, yeah.
All right. I'm into it.
How did parents take it?
You know, it was happening amongst the midst of, like, you know, being pretty depressed and struggling in school for the first time because I was always, like, an ace. School was always easy for me.
And you were obviously an incredible student.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I always worked really hard, but it also always came pretty easily. And I was getting... Like, I got, like, C's for the first time.
In junior year?
Sophomore year.
Sophomore.
Like, I was not doing well in school. Like, I was on academic probation going into junior year. And that was the first time that it happened. And I was very uncommunicative with my parents. They really hated the girl I was dating. Mm. Rightly so. Yeah. They were just concerned. Mm. And they'd never really heard of this thing before. And there was not a whole lot of, like, media products to explain it to them.
Right.
Like, I think my parents, like, understood what being gay was because they saw it on TV.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they, like, got it.
Yeah.
And though they weren't, like, out, there were, like, gay people around Oklahoma City.
Right.
They were just sort of quiet about it.
Yeah.
So my parents got that, but this didn't...
I mean, there was no representation anywhere,
right.
really. And even still now, there's only so much...
Right, especially with trans men.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah,
trans men are, like, super invisible.
Yeah.
And so they, yeah, it. They were not, I think they were just concerned that there was so much else going on in my life. And one of the concerns that, like, a lot of parents have is, like, will you regret this?
Mm.
You're going to grow out of this. Like, is this, you know, a phase, right? All of those typical concerns people have around gender and sexual orientation stuff. And... But eventually, like, they got on board. But I would say, you know, we opened, I don't know if we were recording, but, like, one of the first things I said to you was, like, this is a challenge. This podcast is a challenge for me because I have a hard time being vulnerable. I have a hard time, like, opening up.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that from my parents, right? Like, a question that I never got asked growing up, but I've only am asked on the East Coast is, like, where are your people from?
Yeah.
Like, what is your ethnic origin?
Right.
And I don't know. But what I do know is that my ancestors were cowboys.
Okay.
Right? They're pioneers.
Yeah.
They're people who don't feel feelings. They just work.
Ah, interesting.
So that's where I come from.
Yeah.
And so we don't talk a lot about things.
Did you have an accent growing up?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
Where did you lose it?
I started working on losing it at theater camp because everybody made fun of me for it. Mm. And so I had all these, like, people who'd taken all these diction classes
right.
who teach me
dialect
diction
classes.
Exercises.
Yeah, totally.
To, like, work out of it.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, moving to the East Coast, I got rid of it pretty quickly.
So how does the process start? I mean, how did it start for you?
Well, you tell everybody.
Right.
And then, you go and you see a gender therapist, which there were a couple of those kicking around Boston at the time. And then, you know... eventually testosterone.
Right.
That was the thing.
When you started testosterone, was it like an immediate switch in your brain? Did it make sense? Or does it take time for it to build up? I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Sorry, I haven't talked about starting teen. Jesus, 8 years.
Yeah.
No, you feel testosterone pretty immediate.
Yeah.
Yeah, testosterone's super powerful.
Mm.
Like with the ladies, with the estrogen
right.
and the whatever they take, I don't know too much about it. It does. It will take, like, you know, 9 months, a
right.
year.
Yeah,
to
that's
like,
why I was asking.
But testosterone, yeah, like it's
like,
immediately
boom.
Like.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, what does it feel like?
It felt like, you know, I don't know. It felt like power.
Like power.
It felt like, well, it just felt like. it's hard for people to understand, but like for 20 years of my life, like I just kind of felt like uncomfortable all of the time, at all times. Everything just like existing was like, oh God, this is awful.
Yeah.
And then testosterone makes that better, right?
It makes sense in your head a little bit more, yeah.
Yeah. I remember, so I actually had a mentor. He was my thesis advisor. He was another trans guy. He was an Episcopal priest. And also a professor. I studied religion at Harvard. My degree is like essentially in biblical interpretation.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I have major questions on that.
Yeah, that's one of the things is I'm like, yeah, I get that I'm trans and that's interesting. There's all this other stuff too.
Yeah, totally.
And he was the one I would sort of like be like, I'd ask questions. You know, I could ask questions to. He was like, you know, testosterone like calmed me down. And I would say that is true. That is not necessarily that it made me like a chiller person, but it put a calm to this like, you know, anxious vibration that I'd felt my entire life, right? It just sort of like evened me out in a way. I mean, testosterone is awesome.
Yeah. How often do you have to take it at this point?
I inject every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks?
Which is actually sort of an old school way of doing it.
Really?
Yeah. Most people inject weekly, or there are all these other like ways. There's like a gel and there's like a thing.
Isn't there like a machine that they can put inside of you now that is like an extended release?
There are pellets.
Pellets, yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I sort of like...
Because a bunch of cis dudes take testosterone too to beef up.
Right, or because they have low T levels or whatever it is. There's there are many vehicles. Yeah. When I say old school, every 2 weeks I do an intramuscular injection. So it's like, but I actually, I can't do it. I can't inject myself.
Oh, really? Never happened?
I was, for the first 6 months I was on T, I was able to do it. But then I just like couldn't, I've developed a block.
Yeah.
So I have to have a friend do it. So which is why I do it every 2 weeks, because I don't want to have to like make someone come to my apartment every week and inject me.
Every week.
Yeah.
Over the years, how many friends have you had do it, would you say?
My mom did it for a while. I've had, I think just three. I think just three people.
I just have a couple more questions about trans, and then we can
change
subjects because you're so much more fascinating than this topic. What was your relationship like with your top growing up?
I fucking... Huge knockers.
Oh, you did.
That always sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You never liked him.
No. I don't. Yeah. It became once I was like identified what the issue was.
Right.
That became a bigger problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And what? Just like, what does it mean to be a man to you now? 8 years later, what does being a man mean?
Oh, God.
Because I don't fucking know.
I mean, no, I don't know either.
Yeah.
Right? Like, part of it's a physical thing. There's, like, the physical component.
Right.
Which that's, you know, right? Like, I lift, bro. And
bro.
I, like, wear shirts so you can, like, see my chest
hair.
I've got, like,
fucking porn. You got some good chest hair. Yeah.
No, I'm super hairy. I got to get my back. It takes an hour to wax my back.
Really?
Yeah, I'm super hairy.
Yes.
So, right, there's, like, certainly, like, the physical component for me. And then I think it's a community thing as well. Like, we talked about, like, fitting in.
Yeah.
And it feels like I am related to and am, like, fit into the category that I'm supposed to fit into.
Right.
Like, I just – I'm – like, one of the things I'm, like, you know, that means a lot to me is I am the best man of my buddy PJ.
Mm.
Now, PJ is this, like, you know, 6'4 straight dude. He's a New Jersey State, like, high school heavyweight wrestling champion. He played defensive end at East Carolina, like, big bro. And – I'm his best man at his wedding.
Nice.
250 person, like, big Catholic wedding in New Jersey.
Yes.
Next weekend, I'm not doing Pride. I am throwing a bachelor party for 30 straight dudes in the Poconos.
Yes.
Right?
I love that. But how, like, how proud are you for that, you know?
It is that sort of, like, participation in, like, masculine community.
Right.
Is important
is
to me
so
as a
important.
Person.
Yeah. But you identified today as a gay man.
Yeah.
You said that.
Yeah.
How did that come into play?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Well, we talked earlier about how, like, when I was with like back in my dyke days when I was with women, it was this embodiment of masculinity. I got right. to like, right, like that's how I felt like affirmed in myself. Mm. And then when I no longer, right, when I was like identified as male and like other people identified me as male, I no longer needed that. Right?
Okay.
Right? Like part of, I think, the turn on with women was like I got to be like a man.
Mm.
And then when that left the equation, you know, I talked about like blowing football players in the back of my BMW growing up, right? Like, so I think there was that. There was like always like an attraction to men, but it, you know, I think a complicated part of sexuality is not just who you are attracted to, but who you are in relationship
right.
to another person.
Right, right, right.
Like how they see you and how they treat you. Mm. I sort of got to express my attraction to men in a way that felt right. And I, you know, I had been queer since I was very young,
yeah.
right? Since I was like 13, 14, like basically my entire adolescence and adulthood, I had been queer in some way. And there was a lot of comfort in being able to say like, oh, I'm a gay man. This makes sense to me,
hmm.
right? Because like the last thing you'd want to be would be straight.
right.
Like a straight white man? How terrible would that be?
The enemy.
What a betrayal. You know, and I would say, you know, there is so like also, you know, we talked about consuming all this queer media growing up, but I always like identified with like, I identified with like Will and Grace, right? And I identified with like Brian Kenny and Queer as Folk, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we all identify with Brian, let's be honest.
God, I just thought that would be like the coolest thing to be like rich and powerful and fuck whoever you want. I was like, and not give a shit at all. No feelings.
Yeah, none
it's like,
whatsoever.
This is the ideal. That's who I want to be when I grow up. And I think still somewhere in the back of my mind, what a terrible like formative image.
Oh my, what a terrible like character too, really.
Right. I mean, he's like sleeping with a 16-year-old.
Just hated himself, hated everybody around him.
Right.
Like, hated his job.
And he's who I want to be when I grow up.
But that Corvette, though.
Right?
Yes.
And that loft.
Oh, my God, that loft.
And in Pittsburgh, he probably paid like $1,000 a month for
when
that,
when he bought
right?
the bathhouse and turned it into his apartment, too?
Yes.
God.
Yeah. And then he got to become like a superhero?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. For anyone that doesn't know, this is Queer as Folk history right now.
I think you're one of the first people to like also identify with Brian Kenny.
Yeah.
Or, like, wanna, yeah. Yeah. So I think if you, you know, I guess you kind of go back and you rewrite the history. Mm. But I guess, you know, he and other gay guys were always sort of who I saw myself
right.
growing up into. But I would say, you know, I got shades of gray.
Yeah.
I'm not strict to anything. Right. I'm just up for adventure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you feel more comfortable using the gay term over anything under the bisexual umbrella at this point in your life?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not really that particular about
right.
it.
Yeah. I mean, at this point you've been through.
I say I'm gay, but like most of the time, you know, I also like roll with straight bros. So I don't know that they would appreciate the nuance of being like, well, I'm queer.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, they'd just be like, oh, you're a fag? You'd be like, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
that works.
Yeah, it totally works.
Total big fag.
You're like a bro, is really like.
Me? Yeah.
You're a total bro.
I wouldn't say total bro. I mean, I'm very well versed in the theater.
Yes, 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 yes.
I have very strong feelings that come from away. Should have beat Dear Evan Hansen.
Okay, okay.
But that's just me.
Mm.
Yeah, I run a little bro-y.
I didn't see that. I saw it.
You Dear haven't Evan seen Hansen. Come From Away?
No, I didn't see it.
Darling, get yourself to the theater.
I know.
It's so good.
Is it that much better than Dear Evan Hansen?
Well, look, it is not a knock on Dear Evan Hansen. Dear Evan Hansen is a tremendous musical.
Yes.
Like, you know, Ben Platt is a genius, mm. right? But Come From Away, it just, I mean, it's like a high school level production, right? There's a lot of chair work.
Right.
But the story is just so powerful and so important and so relevant right now
about go see it.
Kindness and hospitality.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, it's about time someone did the Feel Good 9/11 musical.
Mm. I didn't even know what it was about, to be honest with you. Okay, I want to take a few moments here to tell you about Spoke. This is a new listening app from SiriusXM and partner of The Love Bomb. Spoke is more than just a podcast app, okay? It's a social audio platform. You can listen to podcasts, radio programs, documentaries, and so much more.
Have you ever had a difficult time finding a podcast? Psh, I know I have. Well, Spoke has a team of curators, real-life human beings, not robots, who help you discover your new favorite podcast by finding the best moments and highlights from shows and organize them into thematic playlists. Choose from close to 100 different playlists. There's just so many podcasts that I want to listen to, but it's a little overwhelming to start listening to each one, because I have no idea what I'm going to like or what's good. So this is like a friend sharing their playlist with you, right? Allowing you to listen to the best clips from each song. I love it. If you like what you hear, you can join the conversation, leave a voice comment. You can also share anything you find on the app with friends on social media. That's right, hit me up on the gram. You can download Spoke from the Apple App Store or Google Play. Go to hearspoke.com/atwill to support the Love Bomb and all your other favorite At Will shows.
Spreading that love around. This is the Love Bomb.
Let's go to the Bible for a second.
Sure.
Yeah. We talk a lot about the Bible on this show.
Okay.
I feel like a lot of guests that I've had have been raised very much so in the church. And my best friend specifically, Bethany, her family's Baptist. She's very queer at this point. And she still has this like battle with her family on what it says in the Bible about being gay.
Sure.
Can you just give me like a rundown of what you think the Bible says about being gay?
Right. Well, I mean, I think like the biblical scholar in me would want to, address like the method of interpretation you're using the Bible, and what is your relationship to the Bible, and is it to be literally interpreted, or is it this collection of texts over various histories and languages and genres and whatever? Mm. But we'll put that aside because people don't give a shit.
Well, I mean, I kind of do.
we can embed that.
Yes, yes, yes.
But, you know, there are three verses.
Right.
There is Leviticus, right? And the man shall not lie with another man or their blood shall be upon them. Mm. The same punishment is true for, like, eating shrimp or, like, wearing a cotton poly blend.
Right, right, right.
It's...
They're literally in the same, like...
Right. They're like... Because it's a series of laws for priests.
Yeah.
It's like, these are the laws.
For priests.
Yeah. Each book of the Bible, I mean, has a different author. Some of them are written by the same person.
Right.
Or, I guess, depending on your theology, they're all written by God.
Yeah.
But they're written by
That's a conversation that I have a lot. Like, I feel like a lot of people that grew up in the church but aren't educated on, like, really Bible studies...
Right.
...think that the Bible was written by God.
Right. And I just wish I could have a 30-minute conversation with them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's written over, you know, hundreds of years, over different languages. And also, we say the Bible is written, but it wasn't really written. Like, a lot of these are oral traditions which were passed down.
Right, right, right.
And eventually were written down by scribes. But, like, guess what? Nobody has the original copies.
Yeah.
We have copies of copies of copies of copies.
Right.
Within the first four books of the New Testament, so the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there have been identified just as many translation errors as there are words in all four books.
Stop it.
Yeah. And it's not to say, like, which is just, you know, you can't copy a text message that you wrote and write it the exact same way to me twice, right? You're going to make an error.
Yeah.
Which it just, that's what happens when you're copying.
Right,
it's not that people made intentional errors, but like errors were made, and like what, there are more books of the Bible than have made that, like, not every book that was written ultimately made the text. Like, that was decided by multiple councils and, right, like, the Catholic Bible is different than the Protestant Bible, and they have, like, these texts called the Apocrypha, right? And it's, like, a question of whether or not they belong with the real stuff or they're holy or not. And, you know, also, you know, the Bible's not written in English. It was written in different languages.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I talk to people who believe in the literal interpretation, I ask, you know, is the verse, is money the root of all evil or is greed the root of all evil?
Hmm.
Because it's translated equally, money and greed, but they're two very different, the meanings of money and greed are two very different things.
Could not be farther apart, yeah.
Right? So if this is the literal word of God, isn't there supposed to be no room for error or interpretation?
Hmm.
It's... Yes. Yeah. The field is called textual criticism, about how we get the Bible, like, and how the Bible is translated. And it's very interesting. I mean, just the question of translation is so interesting.
Right.
But it informs the question of interpretation. And God, I sound like such a dweeb.
No, I'm so obsessed with this part of the conversation right now.
Yeah. So, like, I come from the I started going to church in college, which is, you know, I think, you know, I came from the Bible Belt. I came from all of these massive mega churches,
but not a religious family. At all.
Not a religious family. But a lot of, you know, people would invite you to church all the time.
Oh, yeah,
and
totally.
Whatever. But my understanding of Christianity, and, you know, also I grew up during the Bush administration.
Right.
I mean, as did you.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rise of the religious right, which demonized, you know, homosexuality and abortion and, you know, all of these things that I believed in. And it all seemed religiously rooted. And my only understanding of Christianity was that it was this anti-intellectual, dogmatic, conservative thing that I just saw as mind control. And then I get to college in Massachusetts. And I remember the first time I arrived in Harvard Square, I looked around and this was in, I think, 2004, 2005, and it was when Massachusetts, which is the first state to legalize gay marriage, was having the gay marriage debate.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the churches were flying pride flags and flew signs that said they supported marriage equality. And this blew my fucking mind.
Mm.
Churches flying pride flags. And the two head priests, not priests, pastors at the time of the university church at Harvard were a gay black man named Peter Gomes, who actually spoke at the first Bush's inauguration.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, very well-regarded Bible scholar, Peter Gomes. He passed away when I was there.
Mm.
And the other one is this crazy lesbian named Dorothy, who is married to Diana Eck, who is a highly, highly regarded scholar of religion and the head of the religion department. And so, yeah, it was a lesbian and a gay man were the head of the church at Harvard.
Oh, my God.
And I'd never encountered smart people who were religious.
Right.
Or liberal Christianity,
yeah,
which takes less seriously, you know, the words of this, you know, book of Peter, this book of Paul, and more this, you know, idea that within the baptism of Christ there is no free, no slave, no Jew, no Greek, no male, nor male, no female, that we are all the same in the eyes of God,
right.
And that the universal love and forgiveness which God bestows upon us, which was taught to us through Christ, is what we should live and seek to spread to others in our lives. And that is the Christianity which inspired me to study religion and almost become an Episcopal priest.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, like, all of the like, trans men in my life were Episcopal priests.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You are blowing my mind right now.
Yeah.
How often do you go to church now?
Never.
Are you, I mean, do you identify as Christian now?
No.
No, you don't. Interesting.
I mean, I don't have, like, a concrete conception of God.
Right. I mean, I think
there was a time in my life when I did go to church a lot, and the Episcopal Church was, you know, very important to me. And I you know, prayed and read and, you know, kept Lent and all this stuff.
I mean, in a lot of ways, you were saved, right, in one way or another by the church.
Well, I would say I was more saved by Survivor.
Okay. Yes. We still have to get back to that for sure.
Right. It definitely provided me something. I mean, I wasn't super religious, but it was, you know, at a time when, you know, when I transitioned, there was still, like, there was this debate amongst all my, like, you know, queer feminist friends about whether or not trans people were the future.
Mm.
Because there was this hesitation that, you know, if gender is performative,
right,
then aren't trans people buying into this idea of the gender binary, which oppresses women and upholds standards of masculinity, right? Mm. Like, shouldn't we all just, you know, seek to be gender fluid or gender queer?
One.
Right.
Yeah.
And liberal people were not, like, thought being trans was a conservative thing. And then conservative people thought trans people were crazy.
Yeah.
And people in the middle didn't know what to think.
Right.
So there, for me, like, it was the, like, it was these, like, people who were invested in Christianity in a way that I don't think that I've ever been, where I found acceptance. The irony.
Yeah, right? God.
Yeah, the people who were most supportive of me as a trans person were clergy.
Yeah.
And people studying to become clergy, because most of the courses that I took were at the Harvard Divinity School.
Right.
With people studying towards ordination, getting degrees towards ordination.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not expect to have this part of this conversation, and I'm so glad it exists.
That's why you were asking questions about tea, and I was like, this is not.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, the first trans man I've had on the show, and like there were a couple questions that we just had to get through.
Sure.
One more question about the Bible and gender identity.
Sure.
In the Torah, there are different genders that are—
And you know what the trans guy one is?
Which one?
Tum-tum.
Is it really?
I'm not kidding.
Yes!
There are several Orthodox rabbis who are trans guys who have been ordained, because women can't be ordained,
right,
but they've been ordained under the gender Tum-tum.
Huh. So, true story. I was in a sauna a couple months ago.
Sure.
I live in South Williamsburg.
Right.
Tons of Hasidic guys.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are fellow residents of Williamsburg.
We are fellow residents. And this guy comes in, this Hasidic guy comes in, and he starts hitting on me, like, hard. And this is a tiny little sauna. It's a small gym.
Sure.
And so he starts hitting on me, and I just find it so strange because – and it's not the first time I've been hit on by an Orthodox guy. But he's so well-versed in the language. He starts asking me how I identify. He, like, throws out the word pansexual, and I was like, yo, dude, like, how do you know these words? Where are you getting this information from? And he was probably early 30s, late 20s, and he – watches YouTube. I mean, he just like...
Sure, the internet.
Yes, the internet. And I threw it back at him and I was like, so the Torah, let's talk. Seven genders. I don't know that much about them. Can you walk me through them? And he was like, what are you talking about? He had no idea what I was even referring to.
Sure. Well, I don't think that's probably like, you know, particularly like the Hasidim who live near us.
Yeah.
Are like... I don't think they're teaching their kids about all of the like diversity of gender.
But if
right?
he knows what pansexual is in today's language.
I guess the Trubin didn't even know within Judaism.
Right. Yeah, that's crazy. And like, you know, in cultures all over the world there have been other genders since the beginning of time. But
sure.
But don't you feel like it has been the Bible in one way or another that has created the binary?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think patriarchal society has created the binary.
Which came from religion in one way or another?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, hunters and gatherers and whatever, but there are early, like, agrarian societies in which women were
the bosses,
whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what, you know, through so much of, you know, the Bible, and I think particularly, like, the Old Testament is, like, you know, it's the Old Testament that's so, like, invested in, like, no gay stuff, no jerking off, no having sex with other women, right? Because imagine, like, if you're the oppressed people called the Jews,
right?
You're this, like, you're, you know, a religious group, but you're more like an ethnic group that, like, is continually, like, oppressed and kicked out of here and kicked out of here, right? You need strength. You need numbers.
Yeah.
You need women to pop out a lot of babies, right? You're highly invested in people procreating, right? And, like, expanding.
Right.
So, of course, like, everything is going to be focused on, like, the procreative functions of sex, right? And you need, at the time, like, you needed women to bear children, and then you needed men to fight, right? Society dictated these, like, two roles.
Yeah.
But we're no longer governed by, like, those ideals or those needs. And I think that's another, you know, layer of interpretation is understanding the history of the time in which the piece was written.
Right.
But, you know, so I had no friends, and my parents were questioning whether or not they wanted to be on board with me being trans, and I watched Survivor.
Yes, okay. We're going full circle here.
Okay. I'm just going to keep bringing it back to Survivor, and you could keep detouring into these other, like,
lanes. Perfect.
Yeah, so I fell in love with Survivor, and it, you know, was the thing that was with me at this really sad point in my life. And then, which was, like, you know, the first time in my life where I experienced failure after sort of, like, not going to being a kid out of the park. I mean, I didn't have any friends growing up. Mm. But, you know, other than that, like...
Until you were how old?
Well, I mean, I had, like, acquaintances, right? I had people, I think, who were, like, wanted to invest in being my friend, but I just was not, you know, I think there's a certain openness and vulnerability required in order to cultivate, like, you know, I'd say real friendship. Let's say, like, the meaningful friendships I have now are, you know, based on that trust, that ability to be vulnerable with one another.
Yeah.
And I was just not willing to do that. I also always saw Oklahoma as temporary.
Mm.
I was like, I'm getting the fuck out of here and never looking back.
Yeah.
And when you have that attitude, you know, it's sort of like saying like, we're going to date, but like there's a definite end date in which I'm going to break up with
her. Girl, I know what that looks like.
Right?
Yes.
So what you don't, you know, it's like being like, we're going to date for 6 months and then have a terrible breakup and I'm never going to call you again.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like you're not going to invest in 6 months, are you?
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, what it would have been like to try to be my friend back then.
Okay.
Also, I was an asshole.
Mm.
You know, I think I...
Well, you were angry.
Yeah, I was very angry.
Because
I didn't understand what was going on with me, and I was upset that nobody else understood me, but I didn't understand myself.
Right.
Like, a lesson it took me, I think, too long to learn was that... Because I was also, like... I did well in school. I thought I was, like, tremendously, like... bright and precocious,
mm-hmm.
and was like a really, really good high school debater.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand why nobody wanted to celebrate those accomplishments. Why my teachers or my fellow classmates, like, I didn't understand why people weren't cheering me on.
Well, they weren't like the cool things to be then. Now, I mean, I think now it's more cool to be those things than it was.
Yeah,
10,
I guess more like it wasn't like so much my classmates as like my teacher. I was like, why don't people? And I think it was generally, I was like, why don't people like? What's wrong with me? Like, I get that I'm different, but like, why don't people like me?
Right.
And I think one of the pieces of the puzzle that I've put together now is that like, I was never nice to people. Like, I was a difficult individual, and I think there's just so much that can be gained if you're just nice to people, even if they aren't
really
nice
true.
To you.
Yeah.
Right? Just like kind of like being a nice, fun person.
Yeah.
And I was not nice or fun.
Mm.
You know, but I don't... I
mean, when did that change? When was that switch?
Well, it was, I think, improv, actually.
Yeah, a pretty big
difference in the way that I related to people.
Mm.
Because, I mean, you want to talk about religion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, improv is a religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a system of ethics with a course of practical application.
Blowing my fucking mind right now. Yeah, okay.
Right? So, like, okay, so watching Survivor, super depressed, graduate from college, moved to New York, start, you know, doing whatever. And then a couple years into it, I start doing improv because I want to pursue writing. And so I sign up for a sketch class at the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yeah, UCB.
But UCB is mostly known for improv.
Right.
And, you know, I have a theater background, but I hadn't pursued that since I was like a sophomore in high school.
Right.
And I just thought, yeah, what the hell? Like, you know, Tina Fey, who was like a writer I looked up to, like, I knew she had done improv, so I was like, why not? And then just like, my first teacher is this brilliant man who the world is now saying is brilliant. His name's Anthony Atamanik.
Mm.
He is known for his brilliant Trump impression, which he does on The President Show
on
Comedy Central.
Yes.
And he played a very important role in my life, right? Like, I just like connected with this guy, and he really encouraged me and told me I was funny, and he was the first person to ever tell me I was funny. But the cool thing I think about Anthony is he also has an interest in religion and philosophy, so he presented improv as this system of ethics, which like appealed to me as like a religion guy.
Right.
And, you know, this idea of like, it's not so much like the yes and, which you typically hear,
right?
But like when you are on stage with a group of people in front of an audience and you've promised the audience a comedy show, you've promised the audience that they're going to laugh, but you have nothing prepared.
Yeah.
And you walk out on stage together with a group of people and you have to have trust with those people.
Yeah, of course.
And you have to be willing to, I think the thing that Anthony like really impressed me, you have to be willing to look stupid so that the group doesn't look stupid.
Mm.
You have to be willing to sacrifice yourself to like do whatever it takes to make sure that your teammates look good so that the show is not about like the audience and making the audience laugh. It is about like fulfilling your obligation to the people you have stepped out on stage with, right? And you have to be good to them and you have to care for them.
You have to trust
on stage
other.
And
yeah.
off, right? And you have to develop this trust with them.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I think improv is the first. I mean, I did a lot of stuff when I first moved to New York to try to like find friends. Like, I played a lot of gay sports.
Mm-hmm.
I played gay softball.
Nice.
I played gay ice hockey.
Nice,
which was a ton of fun.
Yeah. I grew up playing hockey.
I always wanted to play.
Yeah.
I always wanted to play football, but couldn't you know play football. And so hockey was like the closest thing where you could like wear like shoulder pads and a helmet.
Yeah, for sure.
And like go hit people.
And go
But I mean, I'd like never ice skated before.
Oh, yeah. So that's a little.
So
difficult.
I had to learn how to skate.
You could have been a goalie.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I had fun.
Yeah.
You know, it was fun because I couldn't skate that well.
Uh-huh.
So I would just like run into people and like, tackle them. It was great.
Yeah. Laughing the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, I was a terrible hockey player, but I had a blast.
Yeah. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. I think made a lot of friends and like really came into my own because also, I mean, I think you have to understand, I spent so much of my life trying to figure out what I was.
Right.
Right? This, like, fundamental question that most people just accept. Like, I didn't know, like, what the fuck my deal was. Mm. And then because I'd spent so much of my formative years, because I think, you know, it's not until I'm, like, 22, 23 that I've got, like, a deep voice and chest hair and, like, right, like, the whole, all the, everything's clicking.
Yeah.
It took, you know, it takes a couple of years to, like, settle in. It took a couple of years to settle into being a dude, like, figuring out what my pace was.
And, yeah,
like,
of course.
So I'd spent 23
now
years
I'm
of my life
figuring it out.
Right. Like, figuring out this fundamental question of what am I?
Yeah.
And I'd neglected the question of, like, who am I?
Yeah.
And I spent most of my 20s figuring that question out.
Mm.
Figuring out, like, and it's the people I met in comedy who were really the first time I think I, like, found my tribe.
Yeah.
Right? I, like, figured out, like, where I fit. Like, all those years of watching SNL and Adam Sandler movies, and it like, drew me to these, like, comedy people, which is where I, like, I think started to develop a sense of who I was outside of, like, these identity labels of, like, gay and trans and
for
whatever
sure.
else.
Well, what do you want to do with it now? I mean, what's the plan in the space of comedy and writing? I know that you're a writer.
Yeah. Moving to L.A.
You are.
In a couple of weeks. You just caught me.
In a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Have you found a place?
I have. I've signed a lease.
Nice. Where?
West Hollywood, baby.
Yes. Where in West Hollywood?
Crescent Heights Boulevard in Santa Monica.
Okay. Yeah.
Right in the middle of it.
Yes.
I love it. I love that WeHo is, like, walkable.
Uh-huh.
You can, like, go, like, jaunt around, because I walk all... That's my favorite thing about it is getting lost in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get lost anymore, but I love walking around New York.
Yeah.
I will walk miles and miles and miles up and down Manhattan, all through Brooklyn.
Yeah, me too.
I love walking.
Mm-hmm.
It's very funny with writing, because I think the... You know, my goal has always been to, like, you know, sell a screenplay or write for television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make my, like... really weird, dark sitcom, right? That's, like, the goal. The big goal, right? To, like, have my own show. But my sense of humor is very dark and very dirty and very twisted. And I've never, like, considered myself someone who has, like, a universal appeal, which has been the weirdest part of this whole experience, is that I'm, like, so mainstream.
Yeah, right?
But, like, moms from the middle of the country who go to church every Sunday love me. And I'm just...
And, like, empathize with you, right?
Right.
Immediately.
We're very upset that they were...
Oh, my God, yeah.
That something bad had happened to me.
I even told my mom that I was having you on the podcast today, and she doesn't even watch Survivor, but she knew the story just from the news.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, just, like... Make sure it's a good one. Like, send him my love. Like, how like, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. People, are very, like, when most of the time when people stop me, they just, like, hug me.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Right?
I mean, like.
Which is, like, so weird for me from being, like, hated and an outcast and not fitting in anywhere to.
Represent that.
To then just, well, I think, be so embraced and so loved. It's really the first time in my life that I've kind of felt this.
Are you into it?
I don't know what to make of
you
it,
don't
to
know
be
what
honest.
To make of it right now. Yeah.
Well, I think, I guess where I was leading with the writing is that, like, the opportunity which has, like, most easily and abundantly presented itself is to write for teens.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh my goodness. Really? Writing for teens?
Yeah.
And I actually, today is actually a cool day. This is the third of three really cool things I've done today. The first is I got a private tour of Facebook this woman named Emily Vasher, who's one of the most amazing women I've ever met.
Really?
She's the director of trust and safety at Facebook. So whenever there's, like, a terrorist attack, she leads the, like, Facebook's response. Right. So, you know, there'll be all the, like, you know, report if you were at this location, or she coordinates with, like, the FBI to the person's profile, you know, or any of the suspect's profiles. Right. Like, she worked for the FBI for years, like, investigating terrorism, and spent years solving crimes against children, like finding abducted children and like arresting, like, child porn creators.
Wow. She's like an SVU head honcho.
Yeah. She's amazing. Wow. I met her at the GLAAD Awards.
Yeah.
And she brought Andrew Rannells as her date to the GLAAD Awards.
Amazing.
Yeah. Where I met you.
Yeah.
She was just incredible. So I did that and was just, like, left, like, so inspired learning about the culture of Facebook. And this woman who was, like, she was like, yeah, I've seen literally hundreds of thousands of child porn images. But you know what I wake up every day and think? I want to make the world a better place. Wow. And I was like, being able to maintain that optimism and that drive and that amount of energy, I want to do that. Like, that's my favorite thing about my little, like, experience, my little 15 minutes, mm-hmm. is I get to meet the most incredible people.
Yeah, totally.
And there are these things that I identify about them that I want to steal.
Mm.
Like Jeff Probst. He inspires everyone around him in a way that, like, I'll get off the phone with him sometimes and just want to, like, run a marathon at 2 a.m.
Really?
Yeah. He just has this way that he, like, he motivates you. And it's really incredible. Mm. I want to steal that from him. I'm still learning how he does it. But yeah, I think that's so cool, getting to meet all these, like, amazing people.
We have to tell whoever is listening to this what we're talking about,
because right,
people
yes.
might not have any
okay,
idea.
Yeah. Well, I keep trying right? to bring it back to Survivor.
We need to fucking go
we
back to
We opened with my, like, Survivor
yes.
bio. Okay, so, right, yes. Have this, you know, figure out the what I am. That's why I find Survivor.
Yes.
Figure out the who I am. And then, you know, I think when I was watching Survivor back in my depressed days, I sort of thought of it as this impossible thing, right? Mm. Both because, like, I was fat. Like, I used to weigh, like, 260 pounds.
Oh, really?
I had no adeptness in the outdoors, and also, like, I have this lifetime of never being able to have friends.
Mm.
And Survivor is ultimately a game of social chess, right?
Right.
You make relationships, you make alliances,
you break them,
right? You break them, but you have to finesse your way through to convince people to go further in the game with you. And then once you get to the end, you have to convince all the people you voted out to give you $1 million,
mm.
right? So it's a game of influence, and
yeah.
I'm not a person who's ever really. Had influence.
Right.
But, you know, all of a sudden I was like, I was 28 and I had friends.
Mm.
I had really good friends. I had an ability to lead others. You know, I made all these dumb comedy videos and what, right? Like, I had, you know, I sort of, like, had a sense of myself, and I was, like, you know, lifting, fit, in shape. And someone was like, it wasn't someone else. So I was like, I was unhappy. And it's because I, as a kid, you know, I made all these big leaps. Like, I would go to theater camp in the Catskills, and I went to Harvard, right? Like, I took all these big, bold risks and thought my possibilities were limitless. But when, you know, I got depressed and started failing in school, and then I transitioned, I thought, well, my path is limited.
Mm.
As, like, a trans person,
you can only do so.
My options are limited.
Yeah.
And then the world started to change, and that started to open up, and people's you know, understanding of trans people started to change. And I also, you know, I put those limits on myself. And part of the reason I put those limits on myself is that, you know, well, there's no, right? Like, as a trans guy, you don't really have many role models,
mm.
right? You don't have many people that you can say, like, they have gone through these same, you know, journeys, and they have made it to this point in life,
right.
or they've done this or done that. And, you know, it felt like I was sort of, like, pedaling on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked myself, why are you not, why don't you dream anymore?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was, well, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And then I asked myself, what would you do if you were not afraid? If you had no fear? And the first thing that came to my mind instantly, I remember I was on a walk on the pier in Williamsburg.
Yeah.
And the answer, the first thing I would do if I wasn't afraid is I would apply for Survivor.
Yes.
It was what I, you know, it was that thing. And I did. And I didn't talk about being trans in my first video.
You didn't?
No.
So what do? You make a video and you send it in?
Yeah, you make a 3-minute video,
yeah.
send it in. They called me 2.5 hours later.
Really?
Yeah, they called me immediately.
How many people a year are applying?
I think like 30,000 people.
Wow.
I mean, look, I've been making comedy videos for 3 years. So
yeah.
I like.
So you did it.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm a highly eccentric person with a mustache and a weird shirt. Like, who wouldn't put me on a reality
yes,
show?
Yes, ma'am.
And they called me immediately, and we talked, and they were clearly interested. Like, I'd sold them on me. And then a couple of conversations in, I was like,
P.S.
And there's this other thing, too. And they were like, how quickly can we get you to sign everything?
Wow, 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 wow.
Yeah. I mean, they were in.
They were in before you said that, though, for the most
yeah,
part.
Yeah. I mean, they were, but then after that, they were like,
yes, yes,
tripping
yes.
over themselves. And yeah, then I went out to LA, and the first time I met Probst, didn't tell him.
Mm.
I just was like, did the same thing.
Stop dead.
Yeah, there's. I mean, there's this amazing casting producer named Caitlin who is. I took her to the Gay Men's Chorus of LA like Voice Awards few weeks ago, right? Because she's just, she has always got it, and she has always, she's always advocated for me to like be trans on my own terms,
be visible,
right? Yeah. And then told them, and they are like, great. And like the conversation I had with Probst about it was, if, how, and when you ever want to talk about this part of your life, it's up to you.
Yeah.
The caveat being outed by a fellow player.
Right.
Right.
Question.
Sure.
Are you shirtless at all throughout the season?
All the time.
Do you have scars?
Yeah.
And nobody said anything at all?
People ask.
What's your answer?
It's a long story.
Okay. Genius. Yeah. Yeah, that works.
Which is just like people don't really press.
Was there any speculation in terms of like fan forums or anything?
Yeah.
There was prior to this.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. But I played two seasons, but I played them back to back. So my season had not aired by the time I played my second season.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had like 2 weeks in between. That was a wild summer.
Your seasons were where?
Both in Fiji. Survivor is like forever in Fiji at this point.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so then I went out there, and look, I expected to get like voted out third. Mm. This was just supposed to be about like taking a leap and learning to dream again, right? And you know, I love Survivor, and about being a part of this like thing that I love that it meant so much to me.
Yeah.
But I didn't get voted out third. I did really well.
The first time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I lasted 33 of 39 days.
Wow.
Had a blast. Like, really came into myself.
Mm.
Because I.
And you hadn't done anything like this before. There was no like training or anything that you wanted.
Well, I mean, I went to the gym all the time. Right. I like backpacked the Grand Canyon. I bought a bundle of bamboo, which is still on my fire escape, and like practiced making fire with it. And I did the first 2 days we were there, like we lived in a cyclone.
Right.
Like it was mud, it was rain, and we didn't have a shelter, right? Like, and I ultimately it was millennials versus Gen X, which is how we started with this millennial conversation.
Right.
And I was a millennial. Ooh. Ooh. And it was just like the worst. Like nobody, like no one knew how to do anything. I was the oldest guy there.
Uh-huh.
And I ultimately had to be like, all right, gang, we got to get our shit together. Mm. And we have to build a shelter. And I ultimately, like, I made the fire with bamboo. Like, I made fire rubbing two sticks together.
Yes!
It's this, if you watch the first episode of Millennials versus Gen X, it's this beautifully, like, scored moment where I talk about, like, fulfilling my true potential.
I'm going to watch it tonight.
It is. It's very corny. So I really come into my own. Like, I kick ass. I really, like, come into my own. I'm making relationships with people. I'm maneuvering others to my will. I have this, like, great moment where there's this, like, closeted gay cop from Boston who, like, over beers, like, comes out to me on the beach, right? Like, and it's, like, most of the Boston Police Department didn't know he was gay, and he has this, like, big national coming out with me.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. To save myself, I, like, force a tie because I know people are voting for me. But if you force a tie and the tie is unbroken and you're one of the people that's being voted for, then you become immune. And, like, everybody else has to stick their hand in a bag of rocks. And people never go to rocks. And I, like, convinced all these people to go to rocks to save myself.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I exerted influence and power.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm, like, killing it, telling stories in my confessional. Then, I mean, after I do this big thing, I get voted out immediately, which is whatever. I was like, I killed it.
All good. Yeah.
And 20 minutes after I get voted out, Jeff Probst pulls me aside and says, so we have a returning player season coming up. We want you to play again.
Next, in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is like the coolest moment of my life.
Yeah, for sure. Like, absolutely no questions asked.
Because I am one of, at this point, you know, three people. I'm the third person ever to be invited to play what I call the Magnum Edition.
Huh.
The longer, girthier version of Survivor.
Yes.
At my like lowest point, I watched Survivor and saw these like, you know, people who were legends in my mind. These people who did this thing that I could never do. That was impossible for me. And in being invited back immediately, literally being voted out and immediately being called an all-star, I'd like achieved like legend status, right? Like I thought that was something that was impossible and I did it, right? And it was this like, I am dreaming, I am living again.
Yeah.
It was this insane high. And I, you know, signed up and I went back. In my second season, I was playing with all these people that I'd watched. you know?
Right.
All the, like, these people who were my heroes.
Yeah.
Like, this dude, Ozzy, was, like, the first Survivor player I ever fell in love with.
Uh-huh.
His season was the first one I'd watch. And he's insane. He can hold his breath underwater for 5 minutes. He can fish and climb trees and get coconuts. And, like, I was on a tribe with this guy. And we're buddies. Like, Ozzy is now my friend.
Yes.
And, like, that, like, little, like, sad, lonely kid who, like, Ozzy was my TV friend and now he's my real friend. Anyway, so I'm playing with all of these, like, heroes of mine in the season called Game Changers, Survivor Game Changers.
Mm.
And I know all of these people's stories. And there's no guy who's, like, story that I know better than this dude named Jeff Warner.
Mm.
So Jeff Warner played in Survivor 2, Survivor Australia, which was, like, 16 years ago, 17 years ago. And
I can't believe it's been on for so long.
Yeah, then he played again in season 31, which is really when I paid attention to him. And so the thing about Jeff Warner is that he is gay, but does not discuss that publicly.
Mm.
Neither on the first two seasons of Survivor he played, nor during his, like, 15-year career as a network news anchor.
Mm.
But, you know, he talks about his boyfriend on Twitter and whatever. So we end up getting on a tribe together with this other dude named Ty, who's also a gay guy. So we were like, oh, it's like the three gay guys.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try with him for about 4 or 5 days, and then it's Jeff Varner's going to get voted out. I won't get into the reasons why, but he's going home. He knows he's going home. And so we go to tribal council, which is where you vote people out.
Right.
You know, it's where the tribe speaks.
The dramatic music and
right.
The torch and lights and the whole situation.
Yeah. You know, Varner stopped speaking to me before we went to tribal council, and he was running around, and people kept saying he's making, like, below the belt comments about you. Like, he's coming after you personally. Which I was just like, okay. Like, I didn't, like, think much of it. But I knew, like, things might get shady at tribal. And then we are, like, 2 minutes into tribal. And I think he says, like, you know, and Zeke is deceiving you all on levels you don't understand. And he turns to me and says, why haven't you told anyone that you're transgender? And it was like, boom. And I had no idea it was coming. And it just sort of, I remember I looked to Jeff Probst.
Mm-hmm.
Be like, what the fuck are we gonna do now, man? Yeah. And Probst looked away. He looked away. And I was like, oh shit. And I, like, the cameras, you know, the cameras are 30 feet away,
right.
And they didn't move, but they felt like they were right there.
Yeah.
And the lights felt really bright.
Hmm.
And I just sort of went away.
Blacked up.
Well, I was, my mind was moving.
Yeah.
And my body was moving. My legs were going pop, 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 up and down. My arms were shaking. And part of me said, run. But I also knew that, like, I was still on television.
Mm.
And if I ran, cameras were, I was just like, that's going to be such a bad look.
Mm.
You can't run. And I didn't know what to do. And I kind of sat there, like, blank and unthinking. And I knew everyone around me was, like, yelling. But I didn't know what was going on.
Right. They were immediately defending you, right?
Yeah, they immediately rose to my defense. I mean, immediately everyone was like, no, you don't, like, this is the worst, everyone to a person.
Mm.
And, yeah, I think there were a couple of times where I did check back in, and I saw that was happening, and it sort of gave me permission to go back into my, like, I would check in and see what was going on, and everything was like, everyone was defending me, so I would just check back out because I was like, you got to figure out what you're going to say. You got to figure out what you're going to do. And I think my first impulse was like, you got to calm everybody down, right? Because there's no way you're going to, because that was also my, like, you know, I knew that, you know, people might know what the scars were, or it might, you know, right? I was prepared to, like, talk about being trans.
Right.
I just didn't want to lead with it, and then I just didn't think about it.
Right.
And then it became a thing.
Just as in this podcast that, once we started talking about it, like, you're so much more than being a trans man, right? That it just kind of, it's not on the top of the list of what you're talking about. You're just living your life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, right, like, I don't think about it that much. So,
right.
Like, why would you, right.
Right.
You know, eventually, like, one leg settles down and I start to talk and I'm trying to, because also, I mean, there's also this crazy thing of, like, you starve. Like, you don't eat for, like, days at a time.
You're
and
just
you
like
have no
coconuts?
Connection to the outside world.
Yeah.
Your phone has been taken away, and you get no updates. Like, the crew, like, will joke with you about the president being assassinated, you know? And you do what you're told,
mm-hmm.
right? when you're told to do it. Like, you are under total control and your whole world is this game. And the only thing you want is to win $1 million.
Right.
So even in the midst of this, like, moment that will alter the course of my life, it's still in the back of my mind that I'm in a game for $1 million. And now that this happened, I'm going to be in trouble because now I have this great story that I could use at the end to win.
Mm.
So the best thing I can do is try to minimize this for everyone. So I have to stay calm even though I'm exploding inside.
Mm. You went into survival mode.
Right.
Intended.
And I have this, you know, I calm down. I calm everybody down. Then after I calm everybody down, everyone's like, okay, well, Zeke, you're fine. So, like, would you care to say something about this, you well-spoken young man?
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, geez, Louise. Because, you know, also one of the reasons I didn't want to talk about being trans, like, I didn't have anything to say about being trans. Right? Like, I
what does that mean, exactly?
I don't know. It's not like I had a message to the youth. Mm. Right? Like,
well, do you feel like you have a different responsibility now that that was on television?
Yeah. Thank God I had 9 months in the assistance of the amazing people at GLAAD.
Yeah, totally.
To help me figure that out.
Mm.
Look, Jeff Probst took good care of me that night.
Right.
My tribe mates took really good care of me that night. And I, like, had a moment where I, like, you know, made sense of everything and sort of, you know, reflected upon. And I think the thing I was, like, reflected upon, you know, how much I had grown and changed in my life and what Survivor had meant to me.
Yeah,
and that's
of course
what I talked about. Yeah. And then I continued playing Survivor and, you know, who cares? I got voted out a little bit later.
Yeah.
And then I had 9 months to sort of prepare for my grand public outing.
Right.
Before
that episode aired.
Right.
So you left the show. You knew that that episode was airing at a certain date. And
right.
It was like, okay, how am I going to deal with this? Because you knew it was going to be monumental when this episode aired.
Right. I mean, yeah. And we started having conversations in Fiji, you know,
right.
A couple days after I was voted out. Like, Probst and I started talking then about, like, what was the plan? And, you know, the thing that was so scary for me was that Probst said, you know, you're the leader, buddy.
Mm.
We follow you.
Yeah, for sure.
0 to 10. You know, whatever the message is, you figure it out and you tell us.
Mm. Okay.
And we will figure it out together.
Yeah.
And that was the scary part.
Yeah.
You
had work to do.
Right.
Yeah. So how did you find GLAAD?
The show put me in touch with GLAAD.
Okay.
CBS works a lot with Nick Adams, who is this, God, he's this amazing man. He's the director of GLAAD's transgender media program.
Mm.
And, like, the reason why, like, studios and networks and casting agencies and, like, you know, network news are so much more competent when they talk about or deal with trans people.
It's because of him.
It's because of Nick Adams.
Yeah.
And he became kind of like, I call him daddy. Like,
dad.
He became my dad.
Uh-huh.
He's this older gay trans guy.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, has just, like, really highly invested in, like, authentic, responsible representation of trans people.
Right.
You know, and he's the one who also, like, educates all the new trans people, right?
Yeah.
So he's been through it with Caitlin and the Wachowskis and Chaz and Laverne and whatever. And I was, you know, he'd refined his course of, like, and I had, like, trans homework.
Trans study, yeah.
Yeah. I would have to read and watch things, and we would have lunch, or I would call him and have to report back and would fail miserably.
Mm.
Like, I was just, because I never talked about being trans.
Right.
And now all of a sudden I have to talk about being trans and, like, have a message, and I'm like, I didn't want to do this.
Yeah.
I didn't want to, like, be this public trans figure.
You wanted to just blend in, right? You wanted to just be a dude. You didn't want to be a trans dude.
Right. But here's the thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think everybody gets it. I think that's the crazy thing
for
about
sure
what happened is everyone's
that.
Just like, yeah. But I think a big part is that is that they got to watch me for a season and a half on Survivor and just, you know, see me do my thing.
Yeah.
And then they learn this other thing about me, and they're just like, oh.
It's just like your audition tape.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it's been a wild ride. And then after 9 months of waiting, you know, April 12th, 2017, grand public outing.
Yes.
So much bigger than anyone anticipated.
Yeah.
Worldwide news.
Yeah.
I was on The Talk the following day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the following day you were on The Talk.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was scheduled.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it was like you just were in the audience and were like,
I've arrived, Julie Chen. The scary thing about The Talk was, you know, we didn't know what the response was going to be.
Right.
And it was so, I think everyone was really excited that all of the stuff directed towards me was super positive.
Right.
That people were upset that something bad had happened to me.
Yeah.
Like, that was the headline. And it wasn't like, trans shocker on Survivor.
Right.
Right? Or any, you know, the title of the season was Game Changers. Mm. We were worried about any potential, you know, puns on Game Changers. Mm-hmm. No one, you know, everything was so well reported.
Yeah.
And the only, you know, element of controversy was this headline of should they have aired it? And like, did they have my consent to air it? And I was just like, I have been working with CBS and Survivor and Probst for 9 months to come up with, like, how we're going to deal. I'm like, are you effing kidding me? I was pissed that people – that that was what people wanted to say. And I saw those headlines and immediately I, like – I texted, like, the VP of publicity who I work with at Survivor – or at CBS and was like, I want to address this on the talk. Because the thing about the talk is it's scripted. Like, right. You know all your questions ahead of time.
Yeah, I did it too, yeah.
And I was like – I was like, I want to say something. I'm upset,
yeah.
And I want to, right? Because I'm a reality television contestant, mm-hmm. and have been given like unprecedented access to, right, and like influence, and they have listened to me and followed my lead, right?
Your platform's huge at this point.
Yeah. Well, and I think for me, it's like I want to defend the team that like defended me, like the team that went to bat for me. I now want to go to bat for them.
Mm. Oh, I love that.
You know, like Like, Probst has had my back and has, like, fought battles on my behalf. And, like, I want to fight for him now, too.
Yeah.
I got to address that on the talk, and I was
so
glad.
So what's the overall message now?
Well, I think it's, you know, I don't want young trans people to ever believe what I believe, which is that because they are trans, they are limited.
Right.
Like, I don't feel limited anymore.
You don't.
I feel like I can have whatever I want.
Yeah.
I feel like my dreams are attainable with, you know, hard work and goodwill towards others and maybe a couple of strokes of good luck, you know? And because I think that's the worst thing to tell yourself to believe that
you can only do so much.
Right.
Because of
something
how you
about
feel
you
on the inside or what your body represents. Yeah.
Sure. And I think also that part of that too is that you might not have role models.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be your own.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? And like blazing a new trail is certainly scary, but it's don't let the fear define you. Like the fear is telling you that it's the right thing to do.
I mean, how does it feel knowing that you are a role model now?
Thank God.
But dude, it's seriously, like, come on. I mean, the list of trans men is this small.
Yeah. Well, because I also, you know, I Googled, like, public trans outings when I came home from Survivor, and there was, with the exception of Lily Wachowski, all the other headlines were about, they were all women, and they'd killed themselves.
Yeah.
And they're just, I was like, gosh, the next person when they Google this, they need to find a different search result.
There needs to be a different face, yes.
You know, one of the reasons I was so bummed about being outed was that if I wasn't outed, if either I just, like, did season 33 and I was this, like, great player who was, like, a fan favorite and everyone loved, and I didn't talk about being trans, that was a happy trans story,
right?
Because I knew that was always going to be attached to me in some way. Or if I'm, you know, because I was, like, in 34 we were getting, you know, deep into the game and I was like, you have to, like, reflect on this. Mm-hmm. And I not to other players, but, like, in a confessional, right? And to be like, this is a happy trans story because trans stories just aren't happy. They almost always have a sad ending.
Right.
And I think that was important to me, is that my Survivor journey end on a happy note.
Yeah.
Right? That, like, even something though bad happened to me because I was trans, I found a way to make it stronger and, like, propel me to a brighter future. That was important, that there was a happy ending.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I feel like there's two trans stories that have existed. One is the sad story, and one is the story that you don't hear because it's just the passing story, you know? And
sure.
Like, there's no narrative behind it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the, you know, there's the sort of the sad story. Then there's, like, the medium story, which is, like, trans person exists without violence being committed to
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
And that's sort of the barometer of happy story.
Right. But we need
But we
really
don't have,
positive.
Like, the, like, success story.
Yeah. I mean, thank God that it's happening now, you know?
Sure.
I mean, it's happening to... not at all where the place that it should be, but I think we're getting there step by step.
Getting closer.
We're getting closer. Fun little fact. When I was in high school, my first introduction to any sort of trans story, when I was in middle school, 6th and 7th grade, my teacher, Dr. Reed, dude, I spent a lot of time in the principal office. He was like a good friend of mine.
Sure.
I knew he was queer. I didn't know like what the story was, but I knew that he was definitely other than. And then eighth grade, he writes a letter to everyone. And I'm from like a pretty conservative upper middle class area.
Okay.
He writes a letter to all the families. He's returning as a woman, Dr. Reed. Full bottom top surgery, everything. We'll be sitting on a donut for the first 6 weeks. Like, we got all the details.
Wow.
And there are families that left the district. Like, there were, it was like mayhem.
It was a thing.
Yeah. But it was like, I was like, yes, yes, Dr. Reed.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's so hard. Those early years, those like the first 2 years, they're just so hard.
Right.
It's so hard to, the early years of transition, they're terrible.
Mm.
But then you just, you know, you sort of like get to the other side of the rainbow. Not that you're not, you know, always in transition.
Yeah, right? For sure. Well, I think we all are.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. As humans. But those, yeah. Yeah. I think I'm lucky that I got to do that in college, where then I left and moved to a different city, and then, at least for a period of time, had the option of telling people whether or not I was trans.
Right.
Right, of when they found that out, when or if they found that information out about me.
You want to talk about what you did today with these Harlem kids?
Oh, right. Yeah, we started talking about Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess that was the thing is the... I have always considered myself so much an outsider, so not mainstream, and now people want me to, like, inspire the youth.
Right, yeah.
But I haven't talked to a teenager since I was one.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh. And they're so much different than when we were teenagers.
Yeah, these kids were amazing.
They're so smart. They know so much more than I feel like we knew.
Yeah.
God.
They were great. I talked to them for an hour and a half.
Yes.
And I had nothing. I just, like... Because today was like a big day. I was like meeting this bigwig at Facebook and then came so inspired from Facebook, everything I learned about like Facebook. Then I just like marched to the front of this classroom in Harlem.
Uh-huh.
I was like, all right, kids, we're going to talk about goal setting for the summer.
I love it.
And we talked about it. They were very, you know, very curious and asked really good questions. Mm. And one shared like a spoken word poem that they'd written.
Nice.
And the... I hung out with the teachers afterwards, and I was like, how'd that go? I don't know. How'd it go?
Mm.
And they're like, they didn't look at their phones for an hour and a half.
Mm.
So, like, they liked you.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. Because I guess I was just so disliked in high school.
Mm.
But I guess I'm far enough away from being a high schooler where they see me as an adult, but I'm young enough where I'm still relatable.
Right, for sure.
So I don't know. Maybe I will write a book for children. Oh, God, I don't know.
Last two questions. When you hear the name of the show, The Love Bomb, what do you see?
What do I see?
Yeah.
Glitter.
Glitter?
Yeah.
Okay. Love that. Like a glitter bomb?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And do you love yourself today?
Yes.
Yes.
More than I ever have.
More than you ever have, for sure.
For sure. I mean, I still, I guess for me, I'm at the peak of my personal self-love, but I think there is still a very, very far to go.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's like a mountain that has a peak. You know, I feel like it's a stairway to the cosmos, you know?
Yeah. I love myself more today than I ever have.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Seriously, like, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And just, like, what do you think love is? If you could, like, describe it, what is love?
I have no idea. I don't. I would say that love is, I think it's an overwhelming feeling of joy.
Mm.
I think of the people that I love the most. I think of my friends.
Yeah.
And when I think of them, it just fills me with joy.
What's the Bible's definition of love?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's that verse, right? That verse that everyone quotes, that love is... selfless, love is kind, love is whatever. And people always think it's about romantic love. People always quote it on Valentine's Day, and it pisses me the fuck off. Because it's not. It's not about, like, romantic love. It is about the love we are to have with one another.
Right.
It's about how we are to treat each other as people.
Mm.
That interpersonal love, that love of friendship, and not necessarily that love of romance.
Well, I mean, I think the sooner that we can not separate those two...
Sure.
The more beautiful of a place we'll live in will be, you know.
Yeah. If we can love everyone as if we were all lovers.
Yeah, and just like, well,
that was so corny.
If love was lovers and loving loved love, all the love. Well, okay, look, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Nico. I had a great time.
I've loved learning about you, and I don't know. let's just keep this going.
Yeah, let's do it. Cool. Too bad we're not going to be neighbors for much longer.
It's okay. I mean, I'm in LA all the time, and I'm sure you'll be back in New York.
Totally. This is the Love Bomb.
This is the show. Zeke, dude, seriously, fucking love you. You blew my mind. You continue to blow my mind. I'm just so in awe of, like, your wealth of knowledge, you know? I mean, I always think I'm going into these podcasts, into these conversations, like, with some sort of general guideline of where the conversation will be going. But, yo, I had no idea who Zeke was outside of what the media portrays him as. And let me tell you, he's so much more, so much more. He is a force to be reckoned with. I am so excited to see what you come out with in the next few years. Pun intended. But no, seriously, in the comedy space, in the sitcom space, in the television space, like, yo, studio execs, like, be smart. Fucking hire Zeke Smith. Follow Zeke on Instagram. That's at ZekerChief. ZekerChief. And yeah, I guess you can follow me on Instagram. It's at Nico Tortorella. NicoTortorella. And I want to take a second here and just thank the team over here at Will. I've never really done that, and it's kind of silly that I haven't. Will Malnati, Mitch Bluestein, like, for sure, in particular, thank you for cutting these episodes. I know you put so much work into all of this, and I just really, really appreciate it. And Billy, Mr. Billy Graves, your artwork. Yes, love it. Awesome. Thank you. Remember to thank the people in your life that you work with. Love you guys. This is the Love Bomb. Peace. This is the Love Bomb. Spreading that love around. This is the Love Bomb. This is the show. Yeah, it's the Love Bomb. We're taking you up and down. This is the Love Bomb. We're about to explode. Nico. Thanks again to our partner Spoke, SiriusXM's new app that allows you to listen to podcasts, radio programs, documentaries curated specifically just for you. Go to hearspoke.com/atwill. That's HearSpoke.com/ATWILL right now.